Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. For today's podcast, we're talking with Peter Suderman. He is the features editor at Reason, both for the magazine, the website, and every other aspect of the world associated with Reason. Peter, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And the actual reason that we're talking to you, or the proximate reason we're talking to you, is you have an article in the October issue of Reason Magazine, which is on sale now or is available to subscribers now, called Government Almost Killed the Cocktail. And the subtitle is 80 Years After Prohibition, the Dark Ages of Drinking are Finally Coming to an End. So that we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about two kind of related phenomena. One was the effects of prohibition on what had been a glorious 19th and early 20th century tradition of cocktail making in America, and how prohibition kind of really put the kibosh on that and changed the way we think about drinking. But then we're also going to talk about how starting mostly in the 90s and the 2000s, there's been a revival of classic cocktail culture, which is kind of really exciting and fun. I mean, it's very similar to the flourishing of new forms of cooking and kind of world culture coming together to make, you know, our art, our music, our food, and our drinks more interesting. So, Peter, tell us first, your story opens with talking about the classic old fashioned, and you say it's the simplest of cocktails, sugar, bitters, and whiskey stirred over ice, then served on the rocks with a citrus rind. And you say it's the original cocktail, simplest cocktail, and possibly the best, and it almost disappeared from the kind of human catalog of pleasure. Why did it almost disappear?
Well, the reason is prohibition. And if you, the reason I start with the old fashioned is because, like you said, it's the original cocktail. And in fact, if you go back to the 1800s, when people would have said the word cocktail, in many cases, they would have simply been referring to a drink that we now know as the old fashioned. And over time, cocktail culture became more complicated, and you know, more drinks were developed. But it all kind of goes back to the old fashioned. What the old fashioned was there to do was to showcase whiskey. And so what the old fashioned is a bit, usually about 2 ounces of whiskey, a couple of drops of bitters, and then just a little bit of sugar. And so what that does is it balances the spirit inside the drink. And it balances it between that sugar, between the sweetness of the sugar and between the bitters, the bitter flavor of typically Angostura bitters these days. It might have been something more like Boker's bitters in the 1800s.
What are bitters, actually?
So bitters can be made a number of different ways, but typically they are they are spirits that have been infused with bitter flavors and then kind of condensed. And so a very conventional way to make bitters is basically to take Everclear, which is extremely high proof grain alcohol, and then you put orange rinds and nuts and different spices and other things like that in it, and you can create different flavors of bitters.
And so, and that's why you just need
bitters,
a drop or two.
Aromatic bitters,
right? Okay.
And so these are extremely strong. And they can have anywhere from 15 or so percent ABV to above 50% alcohol by volume. In most cases today, when you make an old fashioned, typically it's 2 or 3 dashes of bitters. That's 2 or 3 little tiny drops from a dropper bottle. And I mean, I buy 5 ounce bottles of Angostura bitters, and that's the most commonly used type of bitters. And they'll last me, a year and a half or 2 years. That's what bitters are. And what they're doing there in the cocktail is they're framing the alcohol. And so the idea of a cocktail started with the old fashioned and started with, the whiskey cocktail, this drink that was just sort of the original cocktail, which was to slightly smooth it out with water and then to kind of frame it using a little bit of citrus smell that would come from an orange peel or sometimes a lemon peel or in some cases both. And then the bitters and the sugar, which kind of give it this balanced flavor profile and elevate and kind of shine a spotlight on the whiskey. And then, of course, what happened in 1920 was we had prohibition, and all over the country, alcohol was illegal. You couldn't drink it. You couldn't sell it. You couldn't transport it. Bars basically had to close. And so what happened was drinking didn't go away, of course. People still had their stocks, and there was a very large black market. People were still able to get booze in a lot of cases. But a lot of the booze that was being moved around during Prohibition and being consumed and sold was very bad stuff. And so after Prohibition, when you still see the old-fashioned exists, but the drink has kind of fundamentally changed. It has become this really fruited thing, almost a fruit salad. It's just really heavy on juices and on sort of other non-liquor stuff.
And that's basically to get rid of the or to mask the shittiness of the liquor that's being produced or the unevenness of it. Because if you're using stuff that's made in a bathtub or not really aged properly or has been adulterated by all sorts of, it might be grain alcohol with some food coloring in it or something. So you sugar it up, you juice it up so that people can chug it down without, actually retching.
So that is one of the prevailing theories. I talked to Robert Simonson, who's a drinks writer who wrote The History of the Old Fashioned, a great book about the old fashioned and about how it sort of started modern cocktail culture. And what he says is that no one is exactly sure why the drink changed. But he says, starting in 1934, after the repeal of Prohibition, the drink is just radically different everywhere. And so, there's a very clear kind of marked transition, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to start the piece by just showing the effect of Prohibition on this one classic drink, the drink that started it all. And there's a bunch of, there's a couple of possible reasons. And there may be several, in fact, why it changed. As you said, one is that the whiskey was very bad. And so, you don't want a drink that is just designed to show off a spirit. Another reason that Simonson suggests is that it's possible they just forgot the recipe, because part of what happened during Prohibition was that all of the kind of craft bartenders, the people who knew what they were doing with liquor and could really mix well and create interesting drinks, some of them went abroad, but many of them were older men and they simply retired. And so this is a big part of the article, is that it's not what we lost with Prohibition wasn't just a couple of drinks and wasn't just sort of the freedom to drink when and what you wanted. But we lost an art and a culinary tradition that is really this kind of great, uniquely American thing that started in the 1800s with the old fashioned and then sort of beaded up until Prohibition and then was just cut off nationally by this total federal restriction, basically, on alcohol. There were, again, some exceptions, medical. There were, people could get alcohol for medicinal reasons.
You could get it for sacrament,
your house,
sacramental wine.
You were required to toss them out. You were still allowed to drink that in your own home, but you weren't allowed to transport it, and you had to get permission.
Well, you couldn't. You couldn't produce it? You couldn't produce it or manufacture it and sell it. You could drink it, and there was some exceptions for home use and things like sacramental wine and medical uses. But yeah, I mean, it shut down the industry, and it's kind of like the way, I guess one of the analogies is to the way when the drinking age was raised so that college students could no longer drink, a lot of them stopped drinking, but the ones who did tended to drink in volume and quickly because you weren't sure when you were going to get your next batch. And I know I've read analyses that suggest it's true that fewer people drank during Prohibition, but the ones who did tended to drink more destructively, because it was also outside of kind of social conventions. Let me ask you, before we talk a little bit more about Prohibition, was the Old Fashioned called the Old Fashioned in the 19th century, because you talk about how it was the original kind of, it's what the word cocktail was invented for, or that's what it signified. What was going on with that?
When the drink first appeared, it would have simply been a cocktail, and you would have just walked into a bar and said, "I want a cocktail," and you would have gotten something that would have looked more or less like the whiskey, like an old fashioned made with whiskey today. And then what you saw was, it became the whiskey cocktail because there were other cocktails that were kind of invented along the same lines. And then there were things like the improved whiskey cocktail, which was a whiskey cocktail with some other stuff added to it. There were different versions of this.
Why was it called a cocktail? Do we know that?
This is one of the great mysteries of cocktail history. And while there are some theories, no one is absolutely certain at this point. One of the sort of preeminent cocktail historians, David Wondrich, believes that it had something to do with perking up the tail of a horse or a donkey in order to show one off before sales. And that it has something to do with that. But this is something that cocktail historians, as people have been researching cocktail history and drinking culture over the last 15 or 20 years and kind of gotten back into what people sort of the origins of the cocktail. This is something that they have been looking into and have not settled on an absolutely definitive answer.
And 19th century or rather pre-prohibition drinking culture in America as it evolved in the 1800s, it wasn't like people going out and slamming, 15 cocktails or 15 old fashions. I mean, it was quite different. And you include in the article in the October issue of Reason, on sale now. You can also subscribe at reason.com for about $15 a year. You have the recipe for something called the Morning Glory Fizz, which was that the Morning Glory Fizz, was that named for the flower, or were you supposed to drink it in the morning and, kind of get a pick-me-up for the rest of the day?
It was a pick-me-up. And in fact, that is how cocktails were originally conceived in a lot of cases, was that they were associated with kind of male low-life culture, a group sort of called the, with what we describe as the sporting life. And we don't necessarily, by that, it's not referring to, people who played baseball or whatever the equivalent was, kind of gamblers, kind of men who were considered socially to be of low character. And that was the group that was sort of initially interested in cocktails. And the cocktails were these kind of balanced, somewhat sweeter drinks that were designed to be taken in the morning. Basically, they were hangover cures because the assumption was that you probably were out drinking quite a bit the night before. And so cocktails started as morning drinks in a lot of cases and then became a somewhat different thing over time. And certainly they're not understood as morning drinks anymore. But this was part of the push for prohibition, was that there was a kind of cultural association with cocktails where the idea was, oh, these drinks are for bad people. If you're a cocktail drinking person, if you're a cocktail drinking man, and these were drinks for men, and women really weren't in bars for the most part in the 1800s. And that was one sort of the positive effects of prohibition and then repeal, was that it brought women back, brought women into bars for the first time and sort of started the 20th century mixing of the sexes.
And was cocktail culture generally, it was something that happened in public houses or bars and taverns, as opposed to people making this stuff at home?
That's right. These were drinks made by bartenders. At bars and at gathering places, kind of male clubs in a lot of ways. And as part of that, one of the things you saw before Prohibition were these celebrity bartenders, people who were really quite famous and could be quite well compensated. The most famous of them, of course, is Jerry Thomas. And Jerry Thomas was the first, basically the first bartender to write a book about how to bartend and to put his recipes kind of to organize and categorize and record them so that that other people could see what he was doing. And there were times when this guy was making really quite a lot of money. He also fell out of money a lot. I mean, he was sort of part of this sporting life culture where he lived on the edge and wasn't exactly a planner for the future. But in a lot of ways, what we're talking about when we talk about pre-prohibition cocktails are cocktails in the Jerry Thomas style that come out of his books and his ideas.
Yeah, you mentioned his 1862 book, How to Mix Drinks or the Bon Vivant's Companion, and that he was kind of, when reading the descriptions of him, he had a drink called the Blue Blazer where he tossed flames from one tumbler to another. It sounded like, Tom Cruise and Brian Brennan, that horrible movie Cocktail, from the 1980s, where bartenders are doing all kinds of kind of clowning and antics behind the bar for appreciative drinkers. But so then,
so, I mean, bartending has always been part presentation, right? It's not, you know, and even now, as we've gotten away from the kind of trick juggling, kind of bartending, that's really just sort of it's just a circus act, and the drinks themselves don't matter in that kind of 1980s Tom Cruise cocktail world of bartending. But there has always been an element of showmanship and presentation, and even now, I mean, you can go to bars. I went to a bar a few months ago in Austin, Texas, where they served me a drink inside a miniature treasure box that was smoking. I mean, it's sort of silly and ridiculous. Also, it's kind of fun.
Yeah. So Prohibition comes along, and it essentially just, you know, slams the gate shut on, you know, 100-plus years of experimentation and of a kind of culture, a leisure activity that had its own rules and its own conventions and everything. Here's the question I have for you. And obviously, you know, when liquor starts flowing freely again through most of the states after Prohibition in the mid-30s, the depression is on, so maybe people don't have that much money. But why did it take so long for, because you talk about how the old fashioned came, you know, it was there, but it was kind of, I think you said it was like a fruit salad soaked in whiskey in the article. Why didn't people start kind of upping their game? It seems like, something similar happened with beer, where beer was much more varied before Prohibition. And when it came back, it was much more generally watery and weaker, both in flavor and alcohol. Why did it take so long for people to start taking an interest after Prohibition ended?
This was one of the big questions that I had when I started researching this article was, why did we lose these things for decades? And one answer is that people did try to restart the cocktail world immediately after Prohibition was ended. But there were problems, one of which was that there had been a drawdown of aged spirits. And so it takes a long time to make a lot of good spirits. Whiskey in particular, you're typically looking at stuff that's aged for several years before it gets put out. And so that just hadn't been made in most cases. There were only a handful of distilleries that were still open in the United States during Prohibition. So that stock was just gone. And then in addition, they'd also lost all of the trade deals and all of the sort of the business that allowed them to get, that allowed the United States to get access to foreign spirits. And so that meant that many ingredients weren't available. And then in addition to that, you also had all of these people who had quit the business. Either they'd retired and in some cases died, or they'd gone overseas. And so a lot of you didn't just lose the practitioners, you lost all of their knowledge. And this is the thing that really jumped out at me and kind of that I wanted to drive home with this piece, was that it's not just that Prohibition took away our knowledge of a couple of drinks. It's not just that it kind of killed the production facilities. What we lost with Prohibition was the idea of what a good drink should be. We lost the kind of essential theory that underlies all good cocktails, this idea of balanced presentation of liquor, typically balanced between either sweet and bitter or sweet and sour. And that's the idea that kind of drives most good cocktails, most of the sort of classic drinks that we think. And that was one that we kind of lost for decades. And it's only been in the last couple, 10, 20 years where we've really started to see this come back in a big way.
Well, and let's, two quick points. One, you mentioned that in the Fannie Farmer cookbook, which is kind of the classic American cookbook published in the 1890s, Fannie Farmer, the author, could take for granted that a household would have cooking sherry in its, you know, among it in its pantry. Betty Crocker, who kind of defined post-war cooking for America in a 1950 cookbook, the Betty Crocker cookbook, ends up using a lot of fruit juices and vegetable juices because people had stopped drinking. And I guess Prohibition, I mean,
she uses sherry substitute. So she makes cocktails with vegetable juices, which just, I mean, anything that has sauerkraut juice.
Oh, now you're
also
all wrong.
No alcohol. I'm just, yeah. Maybe.
But maybe tomato sauerkraut juice.
Anti-Midwestern sensibility here.
It sounds pretty good. It's like clamato is also delicious. Tomato juice with clam clam juice in it is fantastic. But having said that, if you look at those two books,
what they illustrate is that in the 1890s, the default assumption was that every American home would just sort of have alcohol in the home and would be comfortable with using it for cooking. And then if you move to the 1950s, the post-war period, the assumption is that that people will not have alcohol in the home, and that's just not part of American life anymore. And so it really kind of drove alcohol and alcohol culture and sort of out of culinary life. And again, this is something that I really wanted to emphasize, is that the modern cocktail scene is a culinary tradition. It is a way of thinking about the presentation of spirits and the mixing of spirits that is driven in part by some, by culinary theory and in part by sort of the culinary revolution that we've seen in the United States over the last few decades.
And to that end, too, one of the things that's fascinating is the idea that it's not just the size of the portion. And in fact, oftentimes, I mean, in cocktails, in classic cocktails, when you have them delivered to you, it's similar to a lot of restaurants where the portion size may be smaller. And the idea is not to be guzzling stuff. I think frequently of what I like to call the buffet belt in America, which in my reading extends up from the Gulf of Mexico up towards Chicago in a pretty big way, where a lot of the times and I say this with all respect to my adopted homeland of the Midwest, but the food that may not have much flavor, but there's a hell of a lot of it. And, that seems to take place. It's the same thing with, when you think about drinking culture, 20, 30, 40 years ago, where, it might be Miller Lite or Coors or something, but it's a bottomless cup or something, so that what you're missing in flavor, you make up for in volume. And it seems just as our food culture has become much more kind of focused on flavor and presentation and a balance of things, so is the liquor culture. Talk a bit about how, like, why did this culture start to get reborn in, and you would peg it to what, the mid-90s, late 90s is when classic cocktails really started to stage a big comeback?
The mid to late 90s is when sort of the when the sparks were happening, and the fire didn't really start until the aughts, and really, and it became a bonfire in the last 5 or 10 years, to use a sort of a weird metaphor there.
Yeah, it's not a good one, by the way, but it's an effective one. Yeah,
it's right. I mean,
it's kind of like
a couple of bartenders who.
I was going to say it's like the Fireball, the cinnamon flavored whiskey that seems to be so hot with the kids now. It's burning a hole through the gullet of American society. I'm sorry. So continue. So it happened in New York.
Right. So, I mean, it started in a lot of ways in New York, at least in the United States. There was also some stuff going on in London. There were other kind of bartenders and home enthusiasts sort of spread throughout the United States. But really the epicenter was in New York when a couple of bartenders basically picked up the old Jerry Thomas book and started paging through them for recipes and started going through and kind of rebuilding and sort of rediscovering this stuff. And some of these bars turned out to be pretty good. They got press, they got attention, they became places that were very difficult to get into in some cases. And a lot of, they were kind of acting as modern speakeasies. Often they would not be labeled, they would not have any sort of sign or, kind of major advertising presence. They were done up in pre-prohibition or prohibition era style. There's a fair amount of kind of mixing of prohibition era aesthetics with pre-prohibition drinking and recipes that was going on. And one of the biggest milestones in this was in 1999 with the opening of a bar called Milk and Honey, a guy named Sasha Petrosky in New York, and just opened this little tiny place set, maybe a couple dozen people. No real sign, sort of a kind of odd waiting list system. You couldn't get traditional reservations, but he was really fussy and fastidious with his attention to kind of cocktail detail. And there were other folks who came in, saw these drinks and said, I got to try that. And so now in New York, you kind of can't swing a cat without running into a pretty good cocktail bar, and there's a lot of really, really great places. But it's also true in the rest of the country, in a lot of the rest of the country, maybe not everywhere. But here in D.C., there's got to be a great, you know, a solid dozen really great high-end cocktail bars. And, you know, part of what I did for this piece was to go to a place called the Columbia Room, which just won the Tales of the Cocktail Award for Best American Cocktail Bar. That's basically kind of the industry award at the major cocktail convention that's held every year. And the experience is just kind of incredible. And it's, I mean, if you like drinking at all, if you've ever sort of liked the idea of sort of a fancy drink, the flavors and combinations and the presentation of all of it, it's highly ritualized, highly intellectualized, and it's also just delicious. And this is stuff that just was not being done in any capacity, and in many ways couldn't be done 20 or 30 years ago because the ingredients and the knowledge just had been all but lost. And so this is why the piece is titled How the Government Nearly Killed the Cocktails, because that it all kind of goes back to Prohibition. Prohibition wasn't the only factor, but it was the major one. It was the start. It was what, you know, sort of took out a lot of this knowledge in the first place. And it's taken decades for us to kind of come back to it and figure it out again.
So it's, you know, I mean, this is really a two-part story. One is, how government policy often disrupts or destroys or upends more than the thing itself that's being regulated. So as you say, it's not just about the booze not being sold, but it's about an entire culture, an entire tradition, a culinary tradition. But then it's also, a story of man's ingenuity, right, to rebuild a lost civilization. It's like rediscovering Machu Picchu, but actually hanging out there and opening up a really good bar at the top of a lost city. Let me ask you this, though, Peter, because, you know, and I'm with you in terms of I love the recovery and the refinement of all sorts of cultural activities. But as you said, you know, this is it's an experience. It's a very intellectualized. It's a very elite kind of activity, for better or worse. Isn't it after a certain point? Is this just kind of mindless energy? And it is kind of elitism. At one point in the article, you diss what a lot of us grew up on, the Long Island iced tea, as a sloppily constructed spirits dumpster. The Long Island iced tea has no sensibility, you say. Is this just snobbiness? Is it just snobbiness and that's okay? Or is it, God, like, you know, can I just go somewhere and get a goddamn beer? If you go to Colorado now where pot is legal, you have to listen to a spiel. It's like a sommelier telling you all about the weed and how you're going to feel and why you should appreciate this and that. It's like, do I constantly need a lesson in, with some guy wearing cuffed sleeves and a handlebar mustache if I just want to get my drunk on?
I mean, I don't know if you constantly need a lesson, but I feel like I do. Look, it's a good question. There is certainly some snobbery that's built into all of this. And perhaps at times I have expressed a little bit of it myself.
I wouldn't go to Long Island anytime soon after that line about the wonderful line of a sloppily constructed spirits dumpster. The Long Island iced tea, which I think is an accurate description.
But so the way that I think about this is that some people approach this in a way that's snobby, but a great cocktail bar will still serve you a shot of Jim Beam if that's what you want. They won't judge you. They will, in fact, sometimes pour themselves a little bit and toast you, right? There's nothing wrong with drinking with drinking beer.
Right.
There's nothing wrong even with drinking a Long Island iced tea. In fact, there's a great one of the things that craft bartenders have been doing is reinventing the Long Island iced tea and other similar types of drinks and trying to figure out how to make them tastier and better. And what we've got now that we didn't have in the 1970s and 80s in particular is the sensibility to do that and the opportunity to kind of intellectualize and raise the bar. And it doesn't have to just be an intellectual experience. It's also just this sort of insanely pleasurable aesthetic experience. It can be very expensive if you want to go spend $30 on a cocktail on a single 3-ounce drink. There are now places in New York where you can do that. On the other hand, you can also get great drinks for far, far less, and you can make them at home in a lot of cases. That's another thing that, you know, sort of, I try to emphasize this, and a lot of the kind of the cocktail thinking and sort of tasting that I have done has just been at home, where you can make drinks and they, you know, your unit cost is a buck. You're not paying $15 to have somebody else mix, you know, mix and make you this stuff. And it's fun. It's a fun thing to sort of do and make for yourself and for your friends and for your family, and to have, you know, dare I say it, Washington, D.C. cocktail parties, which I know we're not supposed to be, you know, involved in.
Oh, God, that's I've heard of such things, but I never seem to get invited. Yeah.
And so, you know, what we've done is we've expanded the range of what you can do with drinking. And in many parts of the country, you can still go and get an old style kind of, let's just dump, you know, a bunch of spirits into a glass and call it, and, you know, mix it with sour mix and call it a cocktail. And, you know, and if that's what you want, there's plenty of places in basically every part of the country that will still serve that to you. But now what we've done is we've expanded the range of possibilities, and we've given people, you know, sort of more opportunities to experience what good drinking can be. And I think that we're sort of, I mean, one of the cases that was made to me was by Derek Brown, who's, in addition to owning cocktail bars here in the United States, is also the spirits advisor for the National Archives, which is just like a great thing that exists. And he really made the case to me that now is the best of all times to be a drinker, because you can drink as simply as you want, or you can drink as ornately as you want. And the cocktail revolution has given us the opportunity to do both, and that just didn't exist 30 or 40 years ago.
So this is, I mean, and the way that you're talking about it, I love the exuberance of it, because it's, you know, what I think, you know, the past 30 or 40 years has kind of shown was that in all aspects of culture, you know, nothing really gets subtracted. We just keep adding on. So you're right. You can still make a Harvey Wallbanger, which, if memory serves, was a drink created, you know, by Hublin spirits in the 70s or something like that. It was just a made up cocktail to try and sell some of, you know, probably rot gut they had rot, you know, spoiling on the shelf. But that's all there. But then you have this other dimension, and it's similar to TV. You know, TV is, you know, the best and worst of old TV is totally available to us. But then we have this great world of fantastic cutting edge TV that you've written about, as others. You know, same thing with food, same thing with everything. It's just this post-scarcity world of cultural activity. It's like, I don't know if Robert Nozick, the Harvard philosopher who talked about it, the libertarian vision as a utopia of utopias, I don't know if he was a drinker, but I suspect he would agree with what you were talking about. You know, just that you can have it simple, you can have it complex, you can have it ornate, you can have it this, you can have it that. So it's a pretty good place. What would, in your mind, is there any way that we could have a prohibition redo, REDUX, where we lose this again? Is that possible, or do you worry about that?
I don't really worry about that. I think there's going to be trends. You know, I mean, we've already seen, if you follow, you know, the cocktail scene and sort of what people are doing and what's hot and what bars are opening and closing, we've already seen kind of movement through. At first, there was a kind of very rigorous, let's only do things the way they were done pre-prohibition. And then people started adding and modifying. And now we've really gotten to this point where people are just trying everything. But at the same time, trying to keep it sort of hot, you know, high quality and interesting. There's been, as in addition to the pre-prohibition cocktail revolution, there's also been a really big movement around tiki drinks. And a lot of these sort of crazy tropical drinks that were, you know, invented, you know, starting the 40s and 50s and during that period of time, people have gone back and figured out how to make them better and how to make them more precisely and more consistently.
Oh, wait. And so this is like the
amazing.
This is like the zombie and stuff like that. The classic tiki drinks.
In fact, the zombie story is great because it basically comes down to one guy named Jeff Berry, who goes by the name of Jeff Beachbum Berry, spent years tracking down the original recipe for the zombie because it was kept secret, not only from competitors and from the public, but from the bartenders who were making it. The guy who had invented this drink had actually, when he had his bartenders, he had them work behind a sort of a screen window area in the bar so that the customers couldn't see what was being done. But then the bartenders themselves were only using numbered bottles because they weren't allowed to know what was in, you know, that what was the secret sauce. And then, of course, Jeff Barry found the recipe, but then there was a problem because one of the ingredients was Don's Mix number 2. And so he's then had to like spend another couple of years trying to find like the son of one of the bartenders who worked at this place who had finally figured out that it was a mix of cinnamon sugar and grapefruit juice, which of course is one of the classic tiki flavors, you know, mixing cinnamon sugar and grapefruit. And it's like this kind of great, archaeological, historical, journalistic project that people have undergone to find all of these old recipes. In addition, they've done things like take historical bottles of rum that don't exist anymore, go and do taste tests, and then figure out how to blend modern rums to get similar flavor profiles, or in some cases even go to distillers and say, look, here's what it used to taste like. Can you make a new bottle like this old one so that we can get the historical flavor of whatever it would have tasted like in 1946 or 1917. I mean, it's really just kind of incredible, these sort of the depths of research that have gone into a lot of these drinks. And, you know, you can totally enjoy every one of these drinks if you don't know the story behind them. On the other hand, part of the fun of drinking a great cocktail is that every drink is a little story. And you kind of can understand it and can deconstruct it. And you can see all these drinks, you know, that are now kind of variations of historical drinks where they've taken the same basic idea, but maybe split. You know, I make an old fashioned that's split between Bass Armagnac and aged Demerara rum. Right. And like, it's just, you know, there's these sort of weird kind of deconstructions of old things that are so wonderful and so much fun to kind of study. And to me, they make the drinking part even more enjoyable.
So this is what you do while you await for the onslaught of Sharia law, right? Inside your gated community, Peter Suderman of Reason.
I mean, I think this is what's going to prevent Sharia law. They're going to have one of these old fashions and be like, you know what? Forget this business.
The old Muhammad.
This is so good. Just tell me the Jerry Thomas story again.
Yeah. No, it is fascinating. And the article, which is entitled, the article by Peter Suderman in the latest issue of Reason, October 2017, it's in subscribers' hands now. It's on newsstands. You could subscribe and get immediate access to it at Reason.com as well for about $15 a year. It's called Government Almost Killed the Cocktail. 80 years after Prohibition, the dark ages of drinking are finally coming to an end. And it's a great story about how government policy often destroys more than even seems apparent at the outset, but also kind of that spirit of innovation and discovery. You know, it would make a great, you mentioned that there's an official cocktail historian at the National Archives. I would love to see the National Treasure movie franchise get re-upped, where it's Nicolas Cage just going in search of Thomas Jefferson's favorite drink or some, or his Madeira, right, or whatever it would be. That might actually be more interesting than the movies that we've suffered through with him. Peter Suderman, thank you so much. He is the features editor at Reason. Peter, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for talking to me. This is a lot of fun.
This is the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie, your host. Thank you very much for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, and while you're there, rate and review us and let us know how you're doing. We'll talk to you again soon.